This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Today we have a rebroadcast of our interview with Kalamazoo writer Robert Weir. He participated in the Living Legacy Pilgrimage last year, touring significant sites of the civil rights movement. Weir wrote about the journey for the February issue of Encore magazine. The interview originally aired February 20th. Robert Weir, thank you for being with us.
Gordon, it's a pleasure to be here with you this morning. Thank you for the invitation to be here.
First of all, explain to our listeners what is the Living Legacy Pilgrimage.
The Living Legacy Pilgrimage is a historical bus tour through 13 locations in the southern states of Memphis, Tennessee, then several locations in Mississippi and Alabama that were key sites in the civil rights movement back in the 1950s and the 1960s. And yet it was not just a historical tour that we went on, because much of the conversation also dealt with the corollaries or the parallels that are happening in the world today in regard to human rights issues. And so history was discussed, but also the application of history to how we can make the world a better place today for all people, regardless of the color of skin.
What made you decide that at this particular point you wanted to be part of this, you wanted to go on this pilgrimage?
That's a great question, Gordon. And it starts with the fact that I was born in 1948, and so I was alive during the civil rights movement, and yet a little too young to be a participant in it. And quite honestly, having grown up in a Michigan rural village that was all white, I didn't know much about the civil rights movement, not until Martin Luther King was assassinated. And so in my adult years, I've begun to write and speak about social issues, peace, justice, the care of Earth, which is a title of one of the books that I've written. And I realized that I'm learning about Martin Luther King and Fred Shuttlesworth and others who were involved in the civil rights movement, but very secondhand. And when I learned about the Living Legacy Pilgrimage, I said, I want to go. I want to go, and at least for 8 days, immerse myself into what happened then. And my gosh, it was an eye-opening experience. I just learned so much about the brutality, the segregation, the discrimination, the lynchings, the beatings, the atrocities that some American citizens inflicted upon other American citizens.
You say that fittingly, this journey begins in Memphis, Tennessee. Why is that appropriate?
Because, let's say, the key figure in the civil rights movement is certainly Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. In Memphis, Tennessee, at the Lorraine Hotel, is where he was assassinated. And on the first day of the pilgrimage, which was a Sunday morning, we went to a church and participated in the service led by an African-American minister in front of an African-American congregation, who said to us, it's such a pleasure to see so many white folks here. And this is what church should look like, where people are there not because of the color of their skin, but because they're people who want to participate in the service. From there, and so that was like the warm-up, but from there, we then went to the National Civil Rights Museum, which, well, it is in the Lorraine Hotel where Dr. King was assassinated, and it is a renovation of that hotel or motel. The National Civil Rights Museum has just got such a comprehensive history about slavery, segregation, the fact that, you know, the education being separate but equal really didn't work out, in slavery today, issues about slavery today. But also, interestingly enough, the Lorraine Hotel or the National Civil Rights Museum includes the boarding house across the road from where James Earl Ray shot Martin Luther King. And his room in the bathroom from which he shot King is there. And you can stand at a window almost right next to
James Earl
where
Ray.
James Earl Ray fired the bullet, the fatal shot, and you can see the trajectory. You can see the balcony. And so it's eerie to stand where an assassin stood.
One of the things you tell us about in this article is a Greyhound bus, a replica of the Freedom Riders bus that was torched by Ku Klux Klansmen in Alabama in 1961. And you say that you find yourself asking yourself a question, which is in the documentary Freedom Riders, could I get on the bus? Do you have an answer to that?
That's a very profound question, Gordon. And first of all, it begins with having seen the documentary, The Freedom Riders, prior to going on this pilgrimage. And I highly recommend that listeners who are interested in what we're talking about today go to the Kalamazoo Public Library or wherever you are and check out some of the documentaries about the civil rights movement. The Freedom Riders was one of those and one of the most powerful that I saw. And interestingly enough, there were news people, news cameramen, who were there recording some of the beatings that happened in Montgomery and also in Jackson, Mississippi. And there are photographs on this documentary of that bus that was torched near Anniston, Alabama. And I remember walking through the National Civil Rights Museum, and it's laid out very well so that you come around a corner and there's another piece of information. You bear to then around the corner in another direction, and there's a piece of information that's new and in a different theme. And I came around this one corner through an archway, and all of a sudden, I'm like 5-10 feet away from this bus. It's a replica, but it's this hulk of the bus. And having seen the documentary and seeing how some people were beaten, I mean, savagely beaten there in the civil rights movement, the Freedom Riders were, just for being white folks and black folks sitting together on the same bus, side by side. And then for trying to use the restroom facilities of the other race or the other color. And they were trying to just be integrated passengers.
And not everyone on this bus was necessarily part of the Freedom Rider movement.
That is correct.
Right.
That's right. I mean, the Freedom Riders just bought their tickets like everybody else and got on the bus.
They didn't charter a bus or anything
No, this was the public transportation system, Greyhound, and there was another national company at that time. And the Freedom Riders just got on these a bus from each of these two companies. And instead of like the segregated mentality of whites sitting in the front and blacks sitting in the back, the Freedom Riders, whites and blacks together, sat together in the same seats, which really apparently didn't cause much of a problem for the bus driver, but for the segregationist, the white supremacist, the Ku Klux Klan, and for police and political authorities there in the South, that was offensive to the segregationists. And so when these Freedom Riders attempted to then get off the bus in a public bus station, like in Jackson, Mississippi, or Montgomery, Alabama, they were hassled, beaten, and savagely. And so having seen the documentary and then at the National Civil Rights Museum encountering that bus, it's like, could I have done this? And again, remember, I would have been a young teenager at the time. But had I been in my 20s, a college student, and known about the civil rights movement, could I have exhibited the bravery that those people exhibited? And realize that the Freedom Riders were not just one group of people. It was the first group, the first wave, if you will, that were beaten savagely. And so when that happened, others said, well, we're going to go too. Other Freedom Riders said, and so
knowing what had happened,
yeah, and knowing that their predecessors a few days earlier had been beaten. In fact, one of the civil rights activists was asked by a news reporter, "Do you realize what you're getting into?" And she said, she was a college student from I think it was Fisk University in Tennessee. She said, "We all signed our last wills and testament last night. They knew they could be killed."
In Mississippi, you say that you end up visiting the scenes of violence and injustice, even more so than in Memphis. And here's a line from your story that stands out to me. This is talking about Emmett Till, today, 40 fresh bullet holes puncture the historical marker that stands where Emmett Till's body was found. This 40 fresh bullet holes, meaning sometime in the fairly recent past, someone felt the need or whatever to pull out a gun and shoot at a historical marker, which notes the brutal murder of this boy in Mississippi.
Gordon, the story of Emmett Till is really an amazing story, and it's continuing today. In 1955, August 24th, 1955, Emmett Till was a 14-year-old black youth. He was raised in Chicago, and so he had some sort of pizzazz about him. But he went to visit his great uncle in Mississippi and made the mistake, apparently, of flirting with a woman named Carolyn Bryant, who was a 21-year-old beauty queen. She was married, and she and her husband owned this little store in Money, Mississippi. And because of the protocol at that time, and I have to give a little sidebar here, that I also spoke with a man, a civil rights activist at the time, who said that you have to realize that as a black man, as a black boy, if I encountered a white person on a sidewalk, it was my responsibility to step in the street so this person could walk by. Also, you never, ever looked at a white woman in the face because that was considered eyeball rape and the punishment was death. Okay, so supposedly Emmett Till committed by flirting did something even more than just looking at Carolyn Bryant in the face. And Carolyn Bryant told her husband, and her husband and his half-brother then went and abducted Emmett Till from the great-uncle's home in the middle of the night at gunpoint. And 3 days later, Emmett Till's body was found in the Tallahatchie River. And the brutality that had been inflicted upon that young man was just significant. He had broken bones, teeth were knocked out, his nose had been chopped at with a hatchet, and his head had been cleaved laterally down to the ears. And then he'd also been shot at point-blank range behind the right ear so that the bullet exited through the left eye. He was immediately put into a casket, and the casket was totally sealed up. His mother, Mamie Till Bradley, was absolutely courageous woman. She said, "I want to see my son. I want that body shipped back up here to Chicago." And then she had the courage, audacity you might say, to say, "I'm going to show the world what happened to my son." And there was an open casket funeral. And something like 10,000 people came there. Some of them fainted. And it was Al Sharpton who said that Mamie Till Bradley was able to bring home what 1,000 speeches couldn't because of people seeing Emmett Till's face. So the story continues today in that it was just recently announced about a week ago that Carolyn Bryant has told a biographer that she made up the story that Emmett Till had flirted with her.
So this flirting, which of course is not something that should have led to the horrible acts committed on Emmett Till anyway, never even happened, apparently.
Apparently not. One of Carolyn Bryant's relatives reportedly said in the news recently that Carolyn really just wanted not to be alone with her kids in the store. She wanted her husband to be there in the store with her. And maybe if she had told, by telling her husband what Emmett Till had done, he would quit his truck driver job and be there in the store with her. So she had an ulterior motive that ended up in this brutal killing of Emmett Till. But yet, again, if you say all things have a purpose, Till's brutal killing then facilitated much of the civil rights movement. Again, this was 1955. This was when awareness was first beginning to occur within the United States about how much brutality was being inflicted upon the African-American people there. And again, it goes on today. We on the Living Legacy Pilgrimage did not actually go to the historical marker with the bullet holes that you mentioned, but it did come up in our conversation, and I checked it out on my smartphone, and sure enough, listeners can look on the smartphone, look up the Emmett Till marker, and there's the bullet holes. And I understand that this is the third or fourth time that the marker's been replaced because of vandalism.
This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Today we are presenting a rebroadcast of an interview with Kalamazoo writer Robert Weir. Last year, he participated in a civil rights pilgrimage that went through several southern states. He wrote about his experience for the February issue of Encore magazine. Our interview originally aired February 20th. In Alabama, you visit another scene of a horrific act of violence, the bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church. The fact that four girls died is disturbing. Is it somewhat more disturbing that it took so many years after that happened for those who had been responsible for it to be brought to justice?
Gordon, your question addresses the mentality of segregation and white supremacy that was so prevalent there at that time. Because, yes, it was on September 15, 1963, when the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham was blasted. Four young girls were killed in that blast. One was 11. The other three were 14 years of age. And within a short period of time, like within a month, a man had been charged and brought to trial. His name was Bob Chambliss, and he was a Ku Klux Klansman. His nickname was Dynamite Bob because he had supposedly and bragged about blowing up the homes and churches of African Americans there in the greater Birmingham area. And he was brought to trial on charges of murder. But the only charges that really stuck is that he was charged a fine of $100 and 6 months in jail for possessing 122 sticks of dynamite illegally. Then in 1977, this would be 14 years later, he was brought to trial again. And this time he was convicted on four counts of murder for killing those girls. And what's interesting at that time, at the time of the first trial, the FBI was involved, but the FBI records, as we look back at them from a later period of time, indicate that FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover had personally been involved in the case and told his agents to withhold information that would have convicted Chambliss at his first trial. That information was released by the FBI for his second trial, and it led to his conviction, as well as the conviction of two of his accomplices a short time later.
While in Alabama, you also retraced the steps of the march from Selma to Montgomery. Just give us an idea of what that experience is like.
That march began in Selma, Alabama, on what's known as Bloody Sunday, when about 600 people crossed the Edmund Pettus Bridge, which leads from Selma, Alabama itself, across the Alabama River into a county area where there's a different jurisdiction. And coming across that bridge, these people were met by Alabama state troopers and county deputies, many of them who had been deputized like the day before and were known to be Ku Klux Klansmen, and significantly beat and tear gassed these people. And this made national news. Then 2 days later, Dr. Martin Luther King was there. He led some more people across the bridge, knowing that they also were likely not to go any farther. No disturbance happened at that time. They knelt in prayer in front of the state troopers and the county deputies and then turned around. This became known as Turnaround Tuesday. Then it was about 2 weeks later, Dr. King was able to obtain a ruling by a federal judge that would allow for the freedom marchers to walk from Selma, Alabama to Montgomery, Alabama, to the Capitol, and again, crossing the Edmund Pettus Bridge. So to get to your question about what it was like, we on this Living Legacy pilgrimage also walked across the Edmund Pettus Bridge. We parked our tour bus on the Selma city side and then crossed in the same direction that the marchers did. The Edmund Pettus Bridge, well, first of all, is named after a man who was a Ku Klux Klansman of high rank and a Alabama senator who opposed the giving blacks rights after the end of the Civil War. He was a senator during the Reconstruction period. And the name, the bridge is still named after him.
Also a Confederate general,
if I'm not mistaken. He was a Confederate general. Yeah. A general in the Confederate Army. Yes, thank you. So for us, we started walking from the city side. And the bridge is of a kind of high humpback design. There were 35 people on the pilgrimage, and we walked in silence, side by side, two by two, on the sidewalk part of the bridge. And I was toward the back of the group so that I could only see the bridge hump in front of me. I could see the backs of people in front of me, the other pilgrims I was with, but I couldn't see what's on the other side. And in this walking, meditative, contemplative kind of state, I began to imagine what it would be like to have been there back in the 1960s and knowing that we were going to have some kind of encounter, whether it would be violent or not. You know, what's going to happen? It really was a historical moment, a living historical moment, to go back and try to experience what it might have been like for the people who were walking then from Selma to Montgomery.
So in Encore, you have a little sidebar story where you talk to some people from Kalamazoo and share their experiences of racism, of being harassed, of trying to forge their own way to achieve some sort of racial equality. How do you think those stories fit in with this civil rights pilgrimage?
The people here in Kalamazoo with whom I spoke are all African-American men and women of a senior age. Some of them are retired. Moses Walker, Dr. Martha Warfield, Dr. Ben Wilson, Dr. Von Washington, and Jacob Johnson, who's a younger man, but he spoke on behalf of his father and grandfather, and Dr. Lewis Walker also. All of these people had some story of how they had been unjustly treated because of the color of their skin. And Moses Walker, for example, who was born in Kalamazoo, said that his mother, who was born in Mississippi, just drummed into him and his brothers, "None of my sons will ever step foot in Mississippi," because she had seen black young men and some women lynched for no reason other than the color of their skin, or maybe because they did something that a white supremacist group thought was inappropriate for good black behavior. Martha Warfield told an interesting story. She was raised in Dowagiac and was a member of the high school band that was allowed and invited to play at the Orange Bowl in 1955. And when they got there, they found that their accommodations were segregated. And there were five black musicians in the Dowagiac High School band. And Martha's parents were among the chaperones. And they said, "Well, okay, if there's no place for our kids to stay here, we'll just go back to Michigan. To heck with the Orange Bowl parade and the halftime show." But the band director said, "Wait a minute. These are all key players, including the drummers. He's the lead drummer. You know, if we're going to be able to perform at all, we need them to be here." And so the black musicians, well, the NAACP got involved there in the Miami area and found accommodations for the black bandsmen at a different kind of a ritzy hotel in Miami Beach, which was not segregated. And it turns out the Count Basie band was playing there. And so the youngsters got an invitation to come and perform for a set with the Count Basie band, a great privilege, which, you know, this is sort of like the good side of the story. But then, as Martha said, the other side of the story is that when we were all together with the white members of the high school band, those white members very dutifully pointed out, well, there's the colored bathrooms, there's the colored drinking fountains, even though back in Dowagiac, they all share the same facilities. It's like the white mentality just said, we are in a segregated state and we need to follow the protocol down here.
So when you come back from this civil rights pilgrimage, do you end up thinking about progress that's been made, or do you end up focusing more on the problems that we still face today and maybe the things where the problems have not been solved or the problems have not gotten any better?
That's a very good point, Gordon. And again, this relates to the modern application of the historical information that I learned on the Living Legacy Pilgrimage. We learned about segregation up until the 1950s and 60s when the Civil Rights Act was enacted. And we learned about the marginalization of minorities here in this country today. We saw signs in the historical displays of segregationists saying, send them back to Africa, as though the African Americans had come here by their own choice anyway. And today we have government politicians who are talking about banning and deporting Mexicans and Muslims simply because of the country they came from or their religion or the color of their skin. Back in the 1950s and 60s, there were voting poll taxes, impossible literacy tests that prevented some African Americans from being able to register to vote. And also people were beaten and shot and lynched simply for trying to exercise that right to vote. And today we have legislative machinations that lead to disenfranchisement of certain voters or voter populations. Back in 1963, it was in Birmingham, Alabama, police used police dogs and high-pressure water hoses on the civil rights activists. Today in Standing Rock, North Dakota, police are using police dogs and water cannons on indigenous environmental activists. There's just so much that is not changing between then and now. I mentioned earlier Hollis Watkins, who the activist who talked about the eyeball rape and the protocol of stepping off a sidewalk as he as a young black man would have to do if he encountered white people coming by. And like within a week after this pilgrimage that I was on and back in November of 2016, there was a young black man, James Means, 15 years of age, was shot and killed by a 62-year-old white man in West Virginia because they bumped into each other on the sidewalk. So things have not changed that much. We listened to speeches by George Wallace back in 1963, his inaugural speech when he was sworn in as governor of Alabama, said segregation yesterday, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever. In November of 2016, during the election cycle, Richard B. Spencer, who's founder of the alt-right movement, said America was, until this past generation, a white country designed for ourselves. It is our creation, it is our inheritance, and it belongs to us. You know, totally disregarding the fact that the indigenous Native Americans were here first. So white supremacy, white privilege, segregation in some ways is still happening in our political world here today.
Robert Weir, thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome.
Robert Weir's story, Remembering the Struggle, is featured in the February issue of Encore magazine. You can find links at WMUK.org. Our interview with Robert Weir originally aired on February 20th. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.